Capitalism is how we feed ourselves, but some now point to capitalism as being the cause of hunger, obesity, land grabbing, global warming, and environmental pollution. They lead us to ask, what is wrong with capitalism?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
There we go. You are tuned into the 1,133rd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Kowloon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Griffin Queener on the boards. Griffin, welcome. First flight.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to have you aboard. You know, it reminds me of my first solo flight in an airplane up there in the big skies of Montana. Mm-hmm. The controller at Logan Field in Billings slotted me number one in the pattern, but they slotted number two as a Northwest Airlines 727. And as I was entering the final approach, the instructor, the control tower called and said, "Expedite, expedite." Meaning, of course, there was a 727 flying up my little tail. But at any rate, welcome aboard. I hope your adventure in first is a little more fun than mine was at that time. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you very much.
Also, pleased to give a big thanks out to producer Sarah Bell Lynn, who pulled this show together through some really incredible times over the holidays. We fought for this show for a long time and finally got it, and Sarah Bell Lynn was a big part of that success. So away we go. Folks, anyone who has owned or worked on a commercial farm did so for compensation. That compensation is the driving force of capitalism, and capitalism is how we feed ourselves. But some claim that capitalism is the reason why billions go hungry in the midst of so much abundance, why obesity has become a worldwide epidemic, and why land grabbing, global warming, and environmental pollution are increasing. And so today we are going to pause to ask, how does capitalism power our food chain? Why is capitalism causing so much trouble up and down the food chain? And if capitalism is so bad, what is the alternative? Here to help us dig for some answers, we have Eric Holt Jimenez, who is the Dr. Eric Holt Jimenez, who is the executive director of Food First and author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Eric, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. I see that you are a slug.
I am indeed.
Indeed? Well, good. So am I. So
maybe you should explain to our listeners what that means.
Oh, yeah. What is a slug? A slug refers to a banana slug, which is the school mascot of the University of California, Santa Cruz. And Eric took his Ph.D. in environmental science from UCSC, and I have a degree in English and Chinese literature from UCSC. And producer Sarah Bell Lynn is an environmental student. Going to be graduating this summer, so away we go. I got a whole bunch of slugs for you folks today. And you're an environmental PhD. What did you bring your PhD about? Tell us about your thesis.
Sure. Let me just say, I also got my master's at UC Davis.
Ah,
I got
an Aggie. You're an Aggie and a slug then.
That's right, my Aggie as well. And I got, I did my PhD on farmers' movements in Central America and, well, Latin America that I'd worked with for 25 years. And it's basically a farmers' movement for agroecology. And these farmers basically had been run over by the Green Revolution. That was the campaign that started in the late 1960s to extend industrial agriculture from the United States to the rest of the world. And they had signed on. They'd taken out credit. They bought
borrowed the money.
Varieties. Yeah, and they had applied all the fertilizers and pesticides and whatnot. And their farming systems crashed. because being small farmers, they've been pushed out onto the marginal land. And the good bottom land had been used for the first stage of the Green Revolution, which were the more capitalized farmers. So the farmers I worked with were poor, and they were going broke because basically they destroyed their soils. They completely upset the balance of insects and the environment and whatnot. And their yields were going down, and the prices were going up, and they were searching for an alternative so they wouldn't have to immigrate and look for work in the cities or in the United States. And they found it in agroecology.
Before you go on, you know, a couple of terms that we probably should deal with. One is agroecology. And in a very broad sense, the Green Revolution, most people, of course, have heard the term, but maybe they really don't know what that means.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of ways of explaining the Green Revolution. I go into it in great detail in my book, Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. But essentially, the Green Revolution was sort of a marriage between marketing and crop science, pushed by the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations in the 1960s.
And now the Gates Foundation, right?
And now the Gates Foundation. But the motivation, it had a mission and a job. The mission was to end hunger, but the job was to resolve a crisis of overproduction for agribusiness in the United States.
So too much food?
No. On the contrary, there was too much. There, it resulted in too much food.
Mm-hmm.
No, there were too many machines and too much fertilizer, too much pesticides, too many seeds. The farmers in the United States and Europe could not absorb these products anymore.
Ah.
And so you had a crisis of overproduction for agro-industry. And so they had to export these factors of production, we call them, to the rest of the world. Well, the rest of the world already had food systems in place. Farmers didn't necessarily have the money or the inclination to adopt these practices. So they were forced through treaties, through different trade agreements, and through different forms of, you know, sort of hardball diplomacy, so that countries in the global south, what we call the developed countries, would take out loans from banks in the United States and Europe and buy these products in order to install what was essentially industrial production in the global south. And the rationale for this was that it was going to end hunger. Norman Borlaug, who was the architect of the high-yielding varieties that were produced.
Father of the Green Revolution.
The father of the Green Revolution.
Saved millions and millions of lives.
Was given the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
I mean, what's not known is that these aren't high-yielding varieties. These are high-consuming varieties. They only work, of course, if you add tremendous amounts of fertilizer, use pesticide, and have irrigation and whatnot. That's great for rich farmers, but for poor farmers who are on hillsides, marginal land, don't have irrigation, and really the only resource they have is their soil, they very quickly destroyed that, and they went broke. So my thesis was about, my dissertation was about how farmers pushed back against this and developed a farmer-to-farmer movement. It spread out throughout the Latin America, and now it's in Africa and Asia and other places, in order to develop an alternative which didn't destroy those soils and also didn't destroy their economy.
And you talk, of course, about agroecology, and of course, UCSC, of which we all went to school, was a big part of that movement with its farm and garden projects up there. Did that have an
influence? Absolutely.
Did that have an influence on you when you were up there?
Oh, that's why I went there, because I'd been actually practicing agroecology with farmers for 25 years without knowing what it was. And just by happenstance, I stopped in at UCSC on a visit to the United States and saw the program was very impressed by it. And they immediately offered me a fellowship to come and get a PhD, so I did.
And there you go. So
we should probably identify, define agroecology as well.
Well, we should do that as soon as we get back from the break that's coming up. And we'll pick up what agroecology is and how small farmers throughout the developing world can use that to go up against the giants of industrial agriculture. Do you ever read, by way of quick example, F.H. King's Farmers of 40 Centuries?
Yes.
Kind of the classic, isn't it? Folks, yes. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're taking a look at how capitalism has shaped our food chain and how that shaping has benefited some, excluded many others, and how those who have been excluded have been finding a way to fight back. And when it comes to farming, it's all about fighting for that consumer dollar. This is the Food Chain. We are at 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us if you dare.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, some years ago when I sat down to write Metro Farm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city, I realized that I had to distinguish between gardening and farming. And the reason I had to do so is because many people who love to garden transpose that love onto farming, thinking, this is so much fun, it's so relaxing, I could do this for a living, and it would be great. But there's a huge difference between gardening, which is an avocation, something you do for fun, relaxation, say hi to the neighbor over the fence. And it's farming is a vocation, which means that you are out there competing for the consumer dollar, and farming is more like war than gardening is like peace, and there's a lot of difference between the two. So if you're a small farmer competing for the consumer dollar with giants of industry, you better have some weapons to fight with. And agroecology has proved to be one weapon that those growing and developing nations have used, that according to Eric Holt Jim Jimenez, who is the author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Eric, tell us about agroecology.
Sure. So agroecology develops about a half century ago at a science, when scientists start observing what farmers actually do. I mean, in agronomy, I learned to tell farmers what to do, apply this, apply that. But these scientists look at what farmers actually do, and they went back to traditional farmers. You mentioned farmers of 40 centuries. So they go back to these millennial traditional ways of farming and try and figure out what farmers are doing to produce a stable surplus over time without destroying their resource base. And so they find that farmers are actually managing very, very carefully the nitrogen cycles, the carbon cycles, the hydrological cycles, the balances between different types of beneficial and destructive insects. And this, then, is the basis for agroecology. And they begin to interact with these farmers, and farmers begin to improve upon their practices and begin sharing practices farmer to farmer around the world. And that's basically the basis of agroecology. So it's very low input in terms of external inputs. There are a lot of farm inputs, you know, and it's also, rather than capital intense, it's knowledge and information intense. So it doesn't lend itself to commodification of products, to simple solutions, to any of these things which we associate with more capitalist forms of agriculture. And it actually is practiced by, in one form or another, by most of the farmers in the world. I mean, actually, what we think about, you know, industrial farming, we think it feeds the world. It doesn't. It only feeds about 15 to 20% of the world. The rest, 70, 75% of the world's food is produced by very poor peasant farmers, most of whom are women. And very tragically, these are the people that make up most of the world's hungry. So we have to ask, and it's a fundamental contradiction of capitalist agriculture, how is it that the people that provide most of the world's food are the ones going hungry?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've remarked or written in Metro Farm that it takes time, money, and know-how to be a successful farmer, and that time here in the United States has always been the most expensive of commodities because you could always sell that time in the city for a lot more money than you could in the country. So money became the primary tool of agriculture. With money, you know, land prices escalate. You can borrow on that land. You can buy tractors. You can buy poisons. You can buy whatever. And then, of course, by realizing economies of scale, you keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the farther you go down that road, the larger you become and the less margin you make on your product, right? About right? Sound right there?
Right. And we get to the place where we're too big to fail. And so we have to prop up, not farmers, but prop up the commodity system with subsidies and these types of things. And it's not like farmers do well as a result of these subsidies. I mean, they would go under without them, most of them. But it's not like farmers do well. What do really well are the corporations that sell inputs to farmers. And what do exceptionally well are the grain companies who like cheap grain and buy that up from farmers. So the thing that's also confusing, I think, for most people is they think that subsidies lead to cheap food, and that's not the case at all. Subsidies come along behind. What leads to cheap food is overproduction. And capitalist food production, just like capitalism, overproduces. We produce 1.5 times more than enough food for every man, woman, and child on the planet today. And we've been doing that for a half century. So we've been overproducing food for a half century, which, of course, cheapens it. And when it's cheap, farmers can't make a living. They have to get bigger. The market gets smaller, as you indicate. So where we are today is that there are a lot of costs to that type of production, a lot of environmental costs and a lot of social costs. I mean, we lose our farmers. We are losing the family farm as we speak.
I think we've probably lost most of them by now, have we not?
I mean, we're losing the middle. Yeah. Actually, the small farms are growing, and very big farms are growing in the United States.
And everything in the middle is roadkill, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
In the middle. Farmers in the middle are disappearing.
This
model is being exported overseas because of the same reasons we talk about with the Green Revolution. It was a crisis of overproduction for the agro-input industries, for the petroleum industries, for the machinery, ag machinery industries. They had to get their products out beyond the United States, and that's what's happening today. This isn't about feeding the world. This is about profits and consolidation of capital in fewer and fewer hands. It's about monopolies, and it's about monopolizing the food system.
So I'm kind of confused about with respect to capitalism, how you define capitalism. To me, it's just working for a living, making some money, no matter which end of that capitalist spectrum you're on. So how do you define it with respect to the food chain?
Well, the capitalism and our food system have co-evolved over several centuries. And food is a very special commodity within capitalism, like no other. And it's a difficult commodity because we need to eat it every day, but we can only eat so much before we're satiated, so it's inelastic. Then we have dairy and fruits and vegetables that spoil, so it's volatile. I mean, we can save grains, but they're vulnerable to hoarding and dumping and financial speculation. And the capitalist solutions that are used for overproduction for other manufactured commodities don't work with food, you know, like planned obsolescence or cutting back on production, things like that. And then finally, you know, like food is not like a smartphone or cars or your latest kicks, you know, sneakers. Food has been considered a human right forever, rather than just the privileges. And without food, none of the other commodities, or labor, or money, or time, has any value, unless we have food.
Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles, right? No food.
Absolutely. Nothing else
seems to work so well. When we get back, we're going to take a quick break. Eric, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about why capitalism causes so much trouble up and down the food chain. And I'd like to take you back to something I found very fascinating, which is how those small farmers found a way to compete with their hands against the giants and Goliaths of agriculture, because I always thought that was the essential problem with small businesses and small farmers, is that nobody told them they have to compete and how to win that competition, and so they go up against those Goliaths and woo, it's like custard to greasy grass. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, you are tuned in to the Food Chain. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, with Eric Holt Jimenez, who is a executive director of Food First and author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Eric, I have to congratulate you folks up there for adopting the name Food First, because your original name was very confusing. So
is the acronym, Institute for Food and Development Policy. If you shorten it, it's called IFDIP. So we thought Food First is better.
Well, Food First. Okay, got it. I like that one because it's something we all know to be true. So you worked throughout the developing nations of the South for quite a while, 25 years, and developing the concept of agroecology. In working with those farmers, did they not practice capitalism themselves?
Well, first let me just say that I also grew up on farms here in California.
Okay.
And worked as a farm worker, basically putting myself to college. So I've also worked in the United States several years doing similar work with farmers in the Central Valley. So my experience is also in the U.S. So, capitalism, there are markets before capitalism. People bought and sold things long before capitalism. What capitalism does is it concentrates wealth, and it extracts and concentrates wealth, and then uses that wealth to produce more wealth, and on an increasingly corporate scale. And so it has to constantly expand because of the competition, because things keep getting bigger, because margins keep getting smaller, called the falling rate of profit. So they have to constantly expand. And so capitalism expands into all other forms of production, all other forms of, all other economic forms of organization, and colonizes them. And you think about how this country
was colonized. What do you mean colonizes them?
Well, that basically brings in its own set of rules and overwhelms the existing forms of production. So, for example, in the United States, we overproduce. And what do we do with this overproduction? Well, one of the things that we do with it is the government buys it and then gives it away. And we think, oh, that's a good thing. It's ending hunger. Actually, it's causing hunger. Because what we do is we give these products to poor countries who then, those governments, sell those products. They don't give them away. They sell them to people at prices which are below the cost of production for the farmers in those countries. So it does two things. It puts those farmers out of business because they don't get subsidies, and so they can't overproduce like that. It puts those farmers out of business, and it attunes the palates and the diets of people in those countries to U.S. products.
Mm-hmm.
So it destroys the food systems there. It colonizes and destroys the food systems in those countries. Now, as long as food is cheap, people are happy. But what we saw in 2008 and 2011, we had tremendous food price spikes, and people went hungry because they had abandoned much of their own food system and let most of their own farmers go bankrupt. And so when they needed to produce their own food, they didn't have the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other side about agroecology. Agroecology is great. It's a good practice. It works. But we also need not food security. We need food sovereignty. Food security is, I give you food when you need it, or you can get food when you need it. Well, you can be food secure in jail. But food sovereignty means you control your food system, right? And it's not controlled from the outside. Henry Kissinger famously said, if you control the oil, you control the government. If you control the food, you control the population. And so what our capitalist food system has done is it has made people dependent on whoever the biggest capitalist players are. Whoever has the most market power controls the food, and that's who people are dependent on, and it fails people. And that's why we have several billion hungry people in the world. I know that the FAO says there's only 860 million. That's a fallacy.
They're
not doing the measuring right.
I'm still confused, Eric, though. And take me back to those farmers that you work with in South, in Central America, wherever, Latin America. And they've developed a means to compete. They have agroecology, which means that they can produce crops with very little financial inputs. They don't have to buy a lot of stuff from middlemen. They work together with other farmers around, and they compete. Is that not capitalism?
Well, that is now, of course. But they also have circuits of production and consumption which are outside of capitalism, based on a moral economy, where people share and give and don't necessarily market their product in global markets at all.
They're selling food, right?
Yeah, they're selling local food. No, that's not necessarily capitalism. It depends on the larger context. It depends on the rules. So it's not just about the practices. The farmers that I worked with during that time were defending themselves against global markets, but they had support. For example, they had land, the ejido system. Land was not privatized. Land belonged to the people through the ejido. And they farmed their plots. They couldn't sell them, but they could pass them down to their kids. But that means they couldn't speculate with the land either. But they also weren't driven off the land. But with the free trade agreements and with globalization and the privatization of everything, they lost their ejido system. And their country was opened up to the subsidized grains from the United States that were dumped at prices lower than the cost of production into Mexico. So even though the farmers in the farmer-to-farmer movement that I worked with were good farmers and produced a product with a minimum of outside investment, when they took it to market, the price just wasn't there. So right now, today, and this has happened, with globalization over the last, 20 years, 30 years, what's happened today is that those farmers are still there, but they're producing at about 20%. Of their capacity because the market isn't there. So those are rules. There are institutions and there are rules which facilitate the concentration of wealth and capital in the food system into the hands of large corporations democratize it away from, smaller local forms of production.
Now, who in those countries is allowing the U.S. to come in with shiploads of grain and dump it on the docks. It seems.
This is all. These are all negotiated. I mean, we went back to the starts back with the Green Revolution. You know, we have a crisis of overproduction of farm machinery and inputs here. In order to get those countries to buy these products, we loan them the money, so they start producing, and then Burl Butts tells farmers in the United States, hey, the world's going hungry, but produce fence row to fence row, and we can feed the world. So pretty soon, everybody in the world is producing. What happens then? Prices crash. So then, the banks, which are private banks in the United States, suddenly say, oh, you know what? We want our money back. And that's when we lost half of our farmers in this country, and that's when in the global south, those countries had to sign agreements with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to be able to not fault on their loan.
Okay, we're going to have creditors. To pick that up, Eric, when we come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain looking at capitalism. What the heck went wrong with it? When we come back, I'm going to ask Eric how to fix it. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, you just heard my friend Will Strickland talk about more of what's eating what, and I guess that's pretty much how I see the food chain, what's eating what. But Eric Holt Jimenez just talked about how the small farmers of Latin America practice what they call a moral economy, and so I'm going to ask Eric, what the heck is a moral economy?
Yeah. Well, I did want to just finish the thought about why countries are letting all this cheap grain in.
All right.
They had to sign agreements with their creditors, and part of the conditionality of those agreements was to let in the cheap grain, drop all the tariffs. That's what NAFTA was all about, for example. And after NAFTA was signed, it didn't take too long, and over a million small Mexican farmers went bankrupt. And so this is how this food system creates poverty and creates hunger. People don't go hungry because there's not enough food in the world. As I already said, we already have 1.5 times enough for everybody. We're producing enough for 10 billion people today. They go hungry because they're too poor to buy the food which is being produced. So the alternatives to this, on one hand, certainly are things like agroecology, which lowers costs and advances sustainable agriculture, and certainly are finding ways to step into the moral economy of mutual aid, and certainly are things that farmers do. You know, farmers have different styles. Many farmers don't throw themselves headlong into the market. Many of them are much more cautious about it. Many farmers don't get on the agricultural treadmill of getting bigger and bigger and buying newer and newer things. They instead intensify production in other ways, through, you know, relay cropping, cover cropping, and companion planting, all these types of things.
The biggest thing small farmers don't do is grow commodities.
Well, yeah, because commodities are a losing proposition.
Yeah, unless you're very, 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 very big.
And then you can still lose it all.
And can profit by selling at a loss. Right?
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, essentially.
So tell me about
the way out of this?
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
I mean, I think on one hand, people are forging the ways out. You know, one is through practices. But the other way is changing the rules. We have to change the rules in the institutions. Otherwise, very hopeful practices in the local agriculture and the urban agriculture and the moral economy, all these things will never be the norm. They'll always be the alternative. Because the rules that are in place today, through the free trade agreements, through the U.S. Farm Bill, which is a bill which sets the price of grain for the entire world, and nobody gets to vote on this, those rules and institutions have to change. Because these are the rules and institutions that have been set in place throughout the development of capitalist agriculture. And, you know, there's very simple things that we can do today, if there was the political will to do it.
Well, wait a minute. One point now. Though, it seems to me like those who make the rules are those who have the economies of scale to make the rules, either through money or the votes. So,
well, I think it's a fallacy to think that farmers make the rules.
Well, that's not, I didn't say that.
Farmers don't expect, well, they don't have economies of scale. I mean, they're the ones, largely the farmers that have economies of scale. That's just to survive.
Yeah.
The, you know, farmers don't export grain. Grain companies export grain.
Right. So how do you, how do farmers, big or small, go about changing rules when they lack the economies of scale to control those who make the rules?
Well, you know, farmers are less than 2% of our population. So in and of themselves, they don't have any political power to create any political will. So they're going to have to form alliances. And they're going to have to form alliances with consumers in order to get these rules changed. And, you know, they're really simple rules, Michael, and I'm sure you're aware of them, too, that were instituted, for example, during the New Deal after the Great Depression, I mean, after the stock market crash, that sought to stabilize agriculture. For example, quota, limits on how much one can produce so that we don't overproduce and drop the bottom out of the market all the time.
Yeah, the parity rules, right?
And parity. Those are the two, I think, are three key areas of rules, which we already know. There are policies which exist, which we don't have in place, but we did it one time, and we could have them in place again. One is parity. In other words, the farmer gets a fair price for the product for which they can have to make a decent living.
Mm-hmm.
Not overproduce.
There's somebody governing all of this stuff, but my problem is that the people who are doing the governing are going to be governed by those who have the economies of scale to govern them. It always seems to work out that way. And so, I don't know. May I shift gears? And I'm so happy to see that you're a Central American expert of sorts on agriculture and political economies. And what on earth is happening to Venezuela, the richest nation in the world in terms of its oil, the poorest in terms of its food?
Well, it's not the richest nation, but certainly the first thing that happened was that the price of oil dropped, and Venezuela had used the oil to subsidize social programs throughout the economy.
Did they subsidize food to the extent that it took farmers out of business?
No, they actually, Venezuela has been on an oil economy for quite some time. And the farming sector has basically languished for quite some time, long before Chavez, for example. And during the Chavez government, they tried to do two things. One was to distribute the wealth of that oil more democratically throughout the population. And the other was to try and revive the farming sector. And they didn't get very far before he died and the price of oil dropped. And now what we're seeing is that the large supermarket chains, who are basically against the current government, are hoarding. And they're hoarding, and food is, even though there's, you know, popular expenditures and stores and stuff for food, for people to buy food at affordable prices, it's just not available. So there's a terrible crisis in Venezuela, of food and oil, and of governments at this point.
Okay, when we come back, I'm going to ask Eric Holt Chavez, who is the executive director of Food First and the author of Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, just what we can do to make capitalism work more better. This is the Food Chain. Right back. You stay tuned.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, The other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy it'll make you blush. Pledge 2 local bucks each day. Get 2 others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
As always, so little time to say it, but we're going to say it as quickly and as concisely as we can. Producer Sarah Bell says, hey, I still don't know what a moral economy is. Eric?
The moral economy was quoted by E.T. Thompson in some of his foundational works a long time ago, but it basically started with food. Where people were going hungry in Europe because of hoarding and speculation and whatnot, and they basically broke down the doors and took the food. Said, look, food is different, and we're not going to obey the rules of this economy which allows for hoarding. We're going to obey the rules of a moral economy, in which everybody has a right to food. And so moral economy is that part of our lives where we make decisions based on what's right, and we don't just leave it up to the market. Because if we leave it up to the market, then whoever has the most market power gets to make the decisions.
I guess that's what they're doing in Venezuela right now. It's breaking into the warehouses and taking the food and doing what they can to survive. Eric, if capitalism is creating so much evil, what's the alternative? What can we do? Can we fix capitalism? Can we adopt socialism or communism or something?
Well, I think it still remains to be seen if there's any single system. I rather doubt it. And I think we have to work from where we are and what we've got. But we have to set our sights on transformation rather just on reforming the system so it continues as it is. So I think that what has to happen is, you know, people are doing a lot of great things. And it's not just the United States. It's around the world in terms of, you know, local food production, local food policy councils, farm to school, organic, agroecological. All these great practices are taking place, which are very difficult to commodify, which are more within the moral economy than the capitalist economy, and which are growing. But at the same time, I would say this is a very progressive trend. But there's also another trend, and which is quite radical. And when I say radical, I mean go to the roots. And that's changing the rules and changing the structures. It's about taking agriculture out of the WTO. It's about reestablishing parity. It's about putting controls on overproduction. It's about recognizing the importance of the environmental services, which farming can, should be providing. So those are real structural issues.
You want to know my other structural issue? I think one thing that we could do that would fix just about everything, and that is to make everybody pay the true costs of production. Because I believe if everybody had to pay the true costs of production, those capital-intensive industrial agricultural techniques wouldn't be so cheap. As a matter of fact, I think they would be very expensive. What do you think, Eric?
Oh, I agree. And I think the other thing we have to do is we have to internalize the externalities.
Yep.
And what I mean by that,
true
I think you know
production.
What I mean by that, right?
Yeah.
So the true cost of production, the environmental cost of production.
Yep.
And the actual factor cost of production. If we do those things, you're absolutely right, Michael. The current industrial food system is no longer viable.
And then
we pay for those things anyway. But the industry doesn't pay. We pay.
That's right. We subsidize things that are very expensive. And every time we subsidize something, we distort its true value. And whenever you distort something's true value, who knows what happens? You end up with Venezuela, I guess. I don't know. But
you end up with the United States. We completely distort the value of things.
So what can we do to fix it?
Well, I think that these two large tendencies that we see around the world of getting the practices right and getting the politics right really have to come together. Because when they do...
Good luck on the politics, then, Eric.
Then you can have... What do I mean by the politics? I mean the structural policies.
Yep.
And, you know, the politics of food sovereignty call for this. And there's a huge movement for food sovereignty around the world, mm-hmm. just as big as the movements for agroecology. Yeah.
You know, there's a great expression of food sovereignty. It's I don't know where, who said it, but give me a fish and I will eat today. Teach me to fish and I will eat always. Eric Holt Jimenez, Executive Director of Food First and author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, thank you so much. Griffin Queener,
thanks for having me.
Great flight. Thank you very much. Sarah Bell Lynn, thank you so much for putting the show together. Great job. See you all next week.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.